Thank you for choosing to listen to Phoenix Fire today. Phoenix Fire features John Anthony West. You can access the Phoenix Fire blog at www.jawphoenixfire.blogspot.com. You can learn more about John Anthony West by going to www.jawest.net.
Phoenix Fire number 5.
This is Phoenix Fire. John Anthony West, rogue Egyptologist and mystic in skeptics clothing, broadcasting from West Henge in the wilderness with something to offend everyone. Welcome to the conflagration. Phoenix Fire. This is part 3 of Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, the convoluted and long tale of what it takes to revise and rewrite all of history. We last left you at the shootout at the AAAS Corral, the American Association of the Advancement of Science Convention in Chicago of February 1992. In the White Hat, the forces of change and heresy and revision, myself, Robert Schock, Thomas DeBecky, in the black hat representing dark, staid convention, Mark Lehner, archaeologist, Egyptologist, and Kalal Gowri, geologist. Now, Son of Mystery of the Sphinx is a long and convoluted tale, or a long and convoluted path, that has more than one lane. See it as a spider's web, with separate strands paralleling, not digressing or diverging from the main tale, but running in parallel and effectively impossible to tell or to follow at the same time. Either you're on one strand or you're on another strand. So in this case, running parallel to our scientific and scholarly revolution, the quest to revise and change history because of the water weathering of the Sphinx, we have the separate strand of making sure somehow or another that we don't get buried, because this is what happens actually with anything revolutionary or radical in any of the sciences or any of the scholarly subjects. And that is that the establishment, by definition, owns the establishment, the playing field. The playing field is never, ever level. Our job now is to make sure that we stayed, that we kept the thing going in front of the public. And in order to do that, we needed media, big-time media, and we had to do this independently. In other words, we were not going to get a university to sponsor us. They were the enemy. We were not going to get even, let's say, conventional sources like Discovery Channel or National Geographic or Smithsonian or any of those people to sponsor us. They were also the enemy. They pretend not to be. They pretend to be open-minded and interested in new things. But when the new things are sufficiently different from the old things, they don't want to know either. So this money had to come from somewhere, and we had to find a way to get ourselves or to keep ourselves in front of the general public. So this involved that strange character that I had known as an adolescent, Boris Said. Bob said he used to call himself when we were both 16 and 17. Now he had grown or graduated into his real name, which was in fact Boris Said, the Boris from his mother who was Russian, the Said from his father who was Persian, and who in fact I understood much, much later played a rather important role in the earliest of the oil, not oil wars, but when it became clear that petroleum, fossil fuels were going to be gigantic money, Boris's father was in some way or another involved in those controversies, in those negotiations, whatever. From the sound of it, as far as I can gather, there's something sort of shady going on. So that doesn't surprise me either when you hear what ultimately became the Book of Boris. So the producer of this enterprise was Boris Said, who I had known way back late 40s when I was yearning for a car and Boris was already professionally driving a XK120 Jaguar and a little 1500cc Maserati racing car. He was left Princeton already and was on his way to becoming a quite well-known race driver. Anyway, Boris was in charge of the production, and the main part of the production, at least in the early days, was finding the money, putting the money together, raising the money to do a video of all of this geological work. Now, Boris billed himself as a producer, but he had actually only a couple of little productions to his credit. Most of his life had been spent racing cars, first for Ferrari, rarely the formula cars, mostly he was on the sports car team, but to be a team driver for Ferrari means you can drive the car pretty well. And then 1 year for Porsche, and then he crashed one of those cars and was in the hospital for about a year and decided that race driving was obviously not his great forte, or he was not going to win the Formula Racing Championship for any year. So he decided to do something much safer, and he became the captain of the U.S. Olympic bobsled team. At some point or another, it was actually in the early 80s, he was captain of the bobsled team, and he crashed his sled at the Lake Placid Olympics, the Winter Olympics, and he decided that maybe he'd better stop doing that sort of thing altogether and decided to go into documentary films. He had one film to his credit, a little film about dolphins, which never got shown anywhere, and another film that was going to be done about the well-known, it's quite famous actually, Zulu shaman named Credo Mutwa in South Africa, and something happened with that film as well. I could never get the story quite straight, and Boris was a very strange and explosive character. And there was something fishy there somewhere, but producers weren't chasing me around, and Boris, with his endless energy and his total fearlessness, he would go into anything, go anywhere, talk to anybody. I have a bit of a phobia about talking to strangers on the phone. Boris could pick up the telephone and talk to anybody as if they had been best friends for the last 50 years. And as I said, with his endless energy, he was out to get the money together so that we could do the film. And he had Boris, an extraordinary character. One of these days, when our geo panel comes back and we have established this question of water weathering of the Sphinx once and for all, which I hope will not be in the too distant future, there will be a book coming out of this. And in that book, I will be able to get into a lot more Boris detail, because he was a fascinating, larger-than-life character with an awful lot of negatives, but some very powerful positives as well. And one of the positives was that he had a vulgar but very keen sense of humor. And at one point, early on, trying to get money from somebody that he'd got money from before, Greek-American guy, and Boris wined him and dined him and wooed him and any number of occasions, and finally came back one day discouraged and said, wow, he said, getting money out of that guy is like getting laid in the 50s. But put it pretty well. Boris was, meanwhile, even as he was trying to raise the money for our film, he was also involved in all kinds of other deals. He spoke good Russian, and he was in some sort of a deal trying to sell some kind of an amazing house building machine that you brought it to the site and you poured in stuff and out came a house to the Russians. And the Russians, he was hoping to get the money from the selling them machines and getting paid, because you couldn't get rubles in those days. They were worthless. But he was hoping to get mink pelts, and there were phone calls back and forth, and Boris flying off to Russia and coming back without mink pelts, but often with big plastic bags of caviar, which was very nice. Anyway, this is an amazing character that was involved with us. And I had already been warned very early on, actually, when I just first re-met him, and he came out to my place in the Catskills with an ex-girlfriend of his, who, and it was very friendly conversation and laughing and old times and blah, blah, blah. And the girlfriend took me aside and said, you know, Boris is a very interesting character, but whatever you do, don't get financially involved with him. And I didn't forget that, but I really didn't have much of a choice because, as I said earlier, producers were not beating a path to my door, and I needed a producer. This was not a thing that I was willing or capable of doing myself, so Boris was that producer. And as time went on, as we were in a state of both continual penury, because I wasn't making any money, and he was also making no money, and so it was up and down, and the whole thing was almost nonstop chaos. Nobody was keeping books. Boris said he was keeping all of the receipts for money that came in shoeboxes. I didn't keep the books. I had a rather cavalier attitude toward it. I felt that my job was to write good books, not keep them. In any event, Boris was chasing up the money and quite successfully, and we had a number of trips to Egypt, actually, where we were doing almost underground filming. We didn't really have permission to film, and somehow or another we were getting the film done. Boris had fired my very great friend Georgiana Kellaway, who was the original videographer, and we connected via Dick Hoagland to Bill Cody, who was a rather more experienced videographer. And now we had a video unit, as it were. We had a photographer, and we had a film assistant, and we had a sound man, and we were a little production company by this time. And Boris was a problem all along. He was a man of immense charisma and absolutely fearless, happy to talk to anybody. He was also, unfortunately, a pathological liar. I used to listen to him on the phone just simply talking absolute baloney to people that he was trying to get money out of. But I kind of reckoned that was what he was doing with other people. He wouldn't deal with us that way, I hoped. But anyway, there was no way out of this, actually. I mean, Boris, I realized that I was on a ride with the captain of the U.S. Olympic bobsled team, and my job was really to sit tight in the back of the bobsled and lean this way or lean that way and not make too much noise, because any violent action on my part as passenger would have meant that the bobsled went off the tracks and we all ended up in the hospital. And this analogy is actually a lot closer to the truth than I wanted it to be, but there was no arguing with Boris. It was done his way or it was not done at all, and if he was confronted, he would threaten to walk off the project, and which he would have done. I mean, there was absolutely no doubt that he would have done that. And my main interest was to make this project work somehow or another at whatever cost. And so very often I would simply swallow what had to be swallowed, and we were making progress. The money was coming in. Jillion anecdotes about Boris. Even as I tell this story, I'm thinking to myself of the endless source of Boris anecdotes, of racing anecdotes and driving anecdotes and personal anecdotes. And actually one of my favorites that I can't resist telling here. Boris was driving. We're exactly the same age. He was born in May of 32 and me in July of 32. And he was driving professionally at an early age. And he knew and was friends with, I don't know how friendly with, but he certainly knew all of the main race drivers of those days. Juan Fangio and Sterling Moss and Phil Hill and all of these. I used to follow the racing. I wasn't in that class myself, but I used to follow it. And anyway, when we got to be friends again, Boris and myself, he had loads of race anecdotes, and one of them concerned Stirling Moss, who at one point, I think he won a world championship or two, but was generally second behind Juan Fangio, the great Argentinian driver. Anyway, until he got into a terrible accident, Moss was the darling of England, and a very handsome guy, a million women following him around, and the hotshot race driver. And Boris told us, Boris's anecdotes, I think, were usually true. And he had one story that he said Stirling used to tell about himself, where he's walking down the street, and a woman says, "Hi, Stirling," and big smile. And Stirling looks at her, and he doesn't recognize her. And he's thinking to himself, "Who is her? What is she? I slept with her? I don't know." And he's trying to keep the conversation going without being too obvious about not knowing her name. And then it rings a bell, something about her sister, something to do with her sister. So he says to her, "Well," he said, "how are you?" And she says, "Fine." And he said, "And how's your sister?" And she says, "She's fine." And Stirling said, "Well, what's she doing these days?" And the woman says, "Oh, she's still queen." It was Princess Margaret. And so that was the story Stirling Moss told about himself. Boris had a million stories of that nature. And apart from the genial, funny stories and the endless anecdotes, he had a terrible temper. He would explode. He was this big, powerful guy. And actually, I used to wonder how the devil he wasn't in jail, because it looked violent. I've almost never seen a temper like that. It was like the worst five-year-old kid's tantrum, but in a 220-pound, very powerful man. And yet he never actually took it out physically on anyone. And one of the Boris things, we named him, it was a matter of pride to him whenever we were flying anywhere to get an upgrade. Even if the flight took half an hour, he'd spend an hour trying to get an upgrade to first class to go from Cairo to Luxor or any damn thing like that. We used to call him Lord Upgrade. And no amount of trouble was too much in order to get this stupid upgrade. And he had loads of stories, actually, of his own, of getting upgrades, how he conned his way onto the Concorde at one point on the film that he was making in South Africa, and all sorts of Boris stories. As we're going along here now, and Boris is getting the money together, we've made several trips to Egypt, and we have most of the film in the can now, but we don't have a script yet. We have tons and tons of footage, and very good footage indeed, and we have our geologists. We filmed the opposition as well. Actually, had I been involved in the editing process, I was in the writing process, of course, we were all co-writing this. I would have given the opposition a bit more rope, as a matter of fact, because one of the things that they complained about after the thing was shown was that, well, we didn't really give them equal time. Well, the fact that we gave them any time and didn't actually misrepresent them was already a victory. The opposite doesn't happen if any alternative thinker is given any space at all on a standard Discovery or Horizon or National Geographic production. We are either grievously misrepresented, or more often than not, we don't have a say in the matter. So the fact that we were actually fair to them, even if we didn't give them anywhere near equal time, was already actually playing a lot fairer than they play with us. In any event, we're moving along toward getting the money together to do this video, and the forces are gathering. Our friend Robert Watts, one of the producers of Star Wars, is able to get us, when the time comes, past the secretaries at NBC, where he has very good connections. Meanwhile, through another set of producer friends, we arranged a contract for $150,000 of upfront production money from a big firm called Trimark, or an international distribution and production company. And unfortunately, in order to get this 150 grand, we effectively had to sell our financial souls. Our lawyers told us that the nature of this contract was such that no matter how much money this thing made in television sales around the world, we were never going to see a cent of it. It was all going to get eaten up in bogus accounting and all the rest of it. And we didn't have much choice in the matter. We needed that $150,000 in order to be able to produce enough of a demo so that we could, in fact, take it to NBC and see if we could get a contract. One thing led to another. Sure enough, all of a sudden, we get an okay from NBC. And we are now on the verge of becoming big time. We are going to be not just a cable production, but we are going to be a primetime NBC network production going out in primetime on the, what are called the February sweeps, the best possible time for any documentary to show, and now we have to choose our host. So hang on, here come the commercials, and we will get back to our host after the break. Thank you. Surprise! Until we find sponsors for our dedicated ad space, it's still John Anthony West, here to tell you about my personally guided Magical Egypt tours. There's a fascination about Egypt, a glamour, a romance. On my trips, people tell me they've been dreaming of traveling to Egypt since early childhood. There are other wonderful sacred places in the world, Gothic cathedrals, Mayan pyramids, Islamic mosques, Hindu and Buddhist temples. But there is nothing anywhere that matches the grandeur, power, and perfection of Egypt. Yet unless you see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you've not seen Egypt at all. For it is only the symbolist interpretation developed by the brilliant philosopher, mathematician, and alchemist R.A. Shvala de Lubitsch that makes sense of the Egyptian experience. Where establishment academics see only a bizarre, architecturally accomplished but still primitive civilization, Shvala saw and proved that it was based upon a profound and sophisticated sacred science, a science of cosmic principles. One wonders how people come back from Egypt and live lives the way they lived them before, wrote Florence Nightingale back in 1850. The answer is, they don't. 2 weeks in Egypt and you will understand the difference, finally, between true civilization and progress. For detailed information, see my website, jawest.net. Click on Magical Egypt Tours. These are one-of-a-kind trips. There is nothing like them. We find ways to avoid crowds. We meditate in the Great Pyramid. We get into places other people don't get into. The food is great. So are the hotels. The price is remarkably competitive. Just remember, if you don't see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you don't see Egypt at all. Welcome back to Phoenix Fire. As we left off, we had just got word that our video was going to be accepted by NBC, and we were going big time, prime time. And now, because it was network, we needed a host who was recognizable to all of Middle America and Upper America and Lower America and all the ships at sea. There were big discussions among us, the crew, all of us, Boris, myself, Bill Cody, everybody involved in making of this thing, who was going to be the host. So we had our favorite, actually, this was, what are we talking about now? We're talking about 93, early 93, late 92, early 93. This is the heyday of Harrison Ford, and of course for NBC, for television, for Hollywood. The host has to have an image. Some professor from Harvard isn't going to do it. It has to be somebody who's instantly recognizable and in some way, shape, or form has a connection to the subject matter. So our first choice was Harrison Ford, then in his absolute heyday with all the great success of Star Wars behind him. But he was A, much too expensive, and B, booked up for the next few years, even though we were told that he liked the idea. Our choices were Raymond Burr, best known for his Perry Mason series, and in other words, his image as the solver of mysteries as Perry Mason, and then at the same time as Raymond Burr, Charlton Heston was also available, no longer at the peak of his success and the peak of his powers, and there the image was, to my mind, not, I preferred the solver of mysteries to the Moses image and the Ten Commandments, because that was, let's say, Heston's shtick. He had his wonderful voice, of course, and he was this marvelous-looking guy. But his politics were not my politics. I didn't particularly want to be associated with those politics, even indirectly. However, I wasn't averse to the idea, and nobody had complete control over who was going to get picked and who wasn't. We all had a say in the matter. And when I mentioned these possibilities to people, Perry Mason, solver of mysteries, Charlton Heston, Moses or Ten Commandments, almost always, if I put that question to a woman, the answer was, oh, Charlton Heston. And I realized that probably at least half of our audience were going to be women. And the women thought Charlton was cool, politics or no politics, and Raymond Burr less cool. Well, we would go with Charlton, and so we did. And it turns out to have been a very happy choice. One, because poor Raymond Burr died shortly. I don't think he would have even had time to make the film. And secondly, Heston, who over his film career is almost always this marvelous-looking actor with the wonderful voice, but terribly wooden in his delivery and in his performances, in part because he was given terrible scripts to do. In fact, for us, he loved the script, he loved the idea, and it was, as far as I was concerned, it was one of his greatest performances. Question of politics was never raised. I wasn't on the shoot. Boris kept me off it, actually, telling me that there wasn't enough money in the budget to bring me out there. I actually knew perfectly well that the reason for not being on the shoot was that Boris wanted the show to himself, but because I was riding in the back of this bobsled, there wasn't much point in making a stink about it, because in fact they didn't really need me there. I was not the film production crew. I was not the cameraman, and I was not the director. Had I been there, I would have been able to correct a couple of little Egyptological mistakes that found their way into the script. But it wasn't the biggest deal in the world, and everybody loved working with Heston, who was a real pro and got this very complicated thing done in one day of, effortless shooting. And everybody was absolutely delighted with the result. We now had all of our footage in the can, and we had to edit and put it together. Now, one of the most remarkable parts of this entirely remarkable story, because I don't know if you listening to this realize how difficult it is to get something that is academically challenging and involves science, and that is B, absolutely revolutionary in its content and in its implications, onto network television in some form that is not ridiculously sensationalized or dumbed down so that five-year-olds can understand it. The fact is that, A, we got accepted by NBC, and the even more amazing fact was that they practically let us do it our way. I mean, anybody who has any experience whatever with television or film industries knows that the most difficult thing of all is for the writers, for the originators of the project, to exercise any control whatsoever over the finished product. This is all in the hands of directors and, still worse, producers, who for the most part are people who have no creative talents of their own, but who control the money flow and who want to show that they really are creative deep down, and often will make completely asinine and destructive changes to any given work simply because they have the power to do so. And one of the reasons why Hollywood is as awful as it is because the producers have so much say in the matter, and the low man on the totem pole, directors, come next in terms of importance, and probably lead actors after that, and last, lagging way behind on the level of importance, is the person who actually creates the thing in the first place, the writer or the originator of the idea. In fact, there's a famous Hollywood joke of, did you hear about the Polish starlet who had an affair with the screenwriter? That's the joke. Hollywood insiders laughed. It has to be a Polish starlet who has an affair with the screenwriter, because no one else would. Anyway, miraculously, NBC is pretty much letting us alone, and we're sending them the finished product as we're getting it done in stages, and they are making a little suggestion here, a little suggestion there. A couple of the suggestions are pretty stupid, but we can live with them. And we're doing fine. They're basically letting us do it our way. And then all of a sudden, and I forget exactly what it was Boris blows up. There's some change or another they want that is quite innocuous, and Boris is absolutely going ballistic. I mean, he is ready to dump this whole thing. He's on the phone screaming and shouting and bullying, terrible bully, Boris, actually, and bullying our producer, whose name I forget. And then Boris is somehow publicly saying that our producer is a cokehead, and he's spreading rumors around all over the place. He is calling up the head of NBC, whose name I forget, but Boris knew him vaguely because he once gave him a ride on his bobsled in Lake Placid, and he's making as much trouble as he possibly can, and we're getting somewhere near to production time. We've got a deadline. It's November 10th. We're going on the air at 8 o'clock p.m., prime time, November sweeps. I mean, it's almost unheard of that a documentary goes out on a time like this on network television, and our competition for this, we know in advance, is going to be the first televised showing of big hit film Dances with Wolves, and one of the other top shows, I forget the name of it, whatever was top of the ratings in those days, something about House or Home, or I forget what it was. But anyways, it was the American Idol of its day in terms of popularity. And so we're on NBC in the middle of this. But Boris is making so much noise and alienating over everybody over at NBC that they refuse to do any advertising for us. And they almost scuttle the show. They almost decide it's not worth it. They've invested, I forget what our budget's about, $625,000. And all that money has, of course, disappeared. The word comes back to us, and we've got to find some way or another to shut Boris up and to simmer him down so that this thing actually goes. By this time, actually, I realize that not dealing just with an explosive and charismatic and explosive and, to a certain extent, effective character, but I'm dealing with somebody who actually has some really more serious problems than I thought. He's basically a sociopath. He's a pathological liar who lies even when it's in his own interest to tell the truth. Unfortunately, he never did get to be president. He travels with a little gray teddy bear. That tells you something about somebody. Everywhere he goes, he travels with that teddy bear. It's the first thing that comes out of his bag when he checks into a hotel room, and then he immediately calls... immediately called room service and ordered champagne for everyone, even if there's no money in the budget. We got a difficult guy here. Somehow or another, we simmer him down enough so that the show is actually going to take place, though NBC, who had planned a huge media blitz, does nothing. Not an ad anywhere, as I recall. It's there. If you look at your TV guide, it's Mystery of the Sphinx with Charlton Heston, a revolutionary look at the Great Sphinx of Giza. But effectively, no publicity. And in order to celebrate this, we're going to throw a party for all of this because we've got lots of a whole bunch of original investors that Boris got the money from. All of our lawyers and all of the people involved in the production, the film crew, all sorts of friends, people who had one role or another to play in this huge thing that's been going on now for, what is it, about 5 or 6 years to put this together. So Boris has booked, forget the name of it, but it's an underground nightclub high in the East Side, 80s or 90s, that is it's the basement of a very big building. It's this enormous thing, deep underground. It's a glorified cellar, but fixed up to be a nightclub. And I guess for venues just like this, we've rented monster 20-foot television screen to watch our show. We haven't seen it yet, mind you. I mean, I haven't seen it. I guess everybody in the production staff has seen it, but I hadn't. So everybody's invited. We've got 250, 300 people at this thing, and on it goes, and it's quite clear as it's going on that we have a success. This is really very, very interesting and vibrant show, and Charlton Heston has done a wonderful job, and all of our audience, everybody is absolutely incandescent. And in the middle of all of this, Boris is suddenly blowing up about there aren't enough chairs, or there are too many chairs, or there's something that the waiters aren't doing right. And there's a huge fuss. We all do a little spiel about our role in this, and Boris is going on and on endlessly grabbing the floor. And embarrassing himself, and he's got somebody there, an Australian Aborigine, talking about some kind of tribal other thing that he's trying to get together. I mean, he's basically throwing a toolkit full of monkey wrenches into this great celebration that's going on. And then there's this enormous fight over something about paying for chairs or extra chairs or something of that sort. And I'm watching this going on, and I'm watching the management looking back and forth at each other and waiting if somebody is going to call the police. And I'm thinking to myself that this whole place has a whiff of mob about it. I don't know who owns this place, this underground place, or where Boris found out about it, but I'm getting the sense that there's something dangerous going on here. But anyway, somehow or another, the party gets held together, and even though Boris has done his best to sabotage it and destroy the fun that everybody's having, and I realize by this time, actually, that I am, that this is sociopathic normal behavior, that he's not a con man. I mean, a con man rips everyone off deliberately and then retires to Rio with a condo and a penthouse and a new Ferrari and laughs all the way to the bank. The sociopath takes everything down with him. And I'm now, by this time, dealing with Boris 3 or 4 years, and the relations are by now pretty edgy, realizing that that's his pattern. That's why the other projects never came to fruition, because one way or another, he saw to it that they got sabotaged. But here, whatever happens from now on, we've had our moment of glory. We've been on NBC in primetime. And the next day, when we wake up and everybody is looking, as they always are, for the ratings, we realize that in much of the country, we've actually been first. In other parts of the country, we've at least been second. It's an enormous audience. Something like 30 million people watch this show. I forget exactly how the ratings work, but whatever the share was, we had a great big chunk of the share. In much of the country, we beat out Dances with Wolves. In other parts of the country, we were second, but a very, very close second. It was up until Fahrenheit recently, Fahrenheit 9/11. It might have been one of the biggest documentary successes ever. And this was against, as I said, I mean, against all of the odds. The fact that it happened at all was completely miraculous. The whole cast of characters that were involved in this, Robert Watts and some of the others that were met through these strange, abnormal circumstances, contacts of contacts of contacts of who knew who and who introduced us when, and then dealing with Boris, who without him, the thing never would have taken place. I never would have been able to pull all those pieces together, but to have this madman in charge of the whole thing, periodically trying to bring the whole thing along with himself down in flames, was the most extraordinary experience. And then we have these tremendous ratings. Now it's up to us, so that simmers down, and here we are. We're a big success. The trouble is, we don't have any money. All of the production money for the $600,000 it was all disappeared. The $150,000 from Trimark also disappeared. And now, and there's no books. Nobody's been keeping any books. There's no accounting. And this is, of course, a big chunk of that is my fault, but I wasn't supposed to do the accounting. As I said earlier, I write books. I don't keep books. Boris was supposed to be keeping the books. And the books were several shoeboxes full of receipts, according to Boris. But where were the shoeboxes? Suddenly the shoeboxes were, it was becoming impossible to get hold of the shoeboxes. And everybody is beginning to smell a rat, because even a rough accounting of the expenses, including Charlton Heston and all of the other things, did not tally out at $625,000 that we had from NBC to produce this thing. There is a big chunk of missing money, a lot. Looks like $125,000, $150,000 has disappeared somewhere, and the shoeboxes are not forthcoming. And now relationship between Boris and myself has become very, very frosty, because I've got the accountants and I've got the lawyers on my side, and we want these shoeboxes because we want an accounting. And it is quite clear that something pretty fishy has been going on. I should say now, actually, that Boris is no longer with us to defend himself. He died at the age of 69, while appropriately enough, watching the Oscars at, when would that have been? 69, we're the same age. 2001, I guess. Anyway, after a long illness and a little bit more on Boris when we come back, because now it's now time for another set of important announcements, advertising ourselves. And when we return, we will have the story of how yours truly rescued the company and saved us from at least total bankruptcy. We return after these important messages. Magical Egypt, a symbolist tour in DVD and more besides. If you can't take a trip to Egypt and experience it firsthand, well, you can't. Not everyone can, but next best and the closest you can get to experiencing Egypt is our 8-episode documentary series, Magical Egypt, a symbolist tour. This is the brainchild of my partner, Chance Gardner, a graphic designer and 3D animator of genius, and this series is an absolutely unique visual, emotional, and intellectual media experience. There are innumerable documentaries about Egypt, dry as dust, misleading, repetitive exercises in Egyptological establishmentarianism from the National Geographic or Discovery Channel or some other wielder of the academic cookie cutter, pretty pictures, nothing ever that feeds the mind, the heart, to say nothing of the soul. This series fills that gap. We explore Egypt in depth. We follow the ramifications into alchemy, the tarot deck, modern DNA research, sacred geometry, the mysteries of ancient technology. There are interviews with leading-edge scholars, scientists, and thinkers, each contributing to a radical revision of our understanding of the past. For more information, go to www.magicalegypt.com and more. If you've not read my Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, maybe it's time you did. An in-depth introduction to Shwela de Lubitsch's symbolist interpretation. Our Emmy Award-winning classic documentary, Mystery of the Sphinx, now available in an upgraded DVD version. My guidebook, A Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, an invaluable source of information for armchair and actual travelers to Egypt. I have a few copies of my out-of-print first nonfiction book, The Case for Astrology, left for sale. See my website, www.jawest.net. Click on books. Welcome back to Phoenix Fire, and we continue with the Book of Boris. We last left our situation with having our great success with Mystery of the Sphinx on NBC, recognizing that something is very wrong with the accounting. Well, there hadn't been any accounting, but there's a lot of money missing somewhere or another. But we know that we're not going to make money out of the documentary itself. Where the money is going to come from, if we are ever actually going to get into some sort of profit, most of us got paid almost little or nothing for actually making this thing. The budget disappeared into production costs and, as we will soon discover, into Boris plundering the till. But anyway, if we're going to make money out of this thing for all of this incredible amount of hard work, it's going to come from home video sales, because we're not going to get anything from foreign rights, because Trimark has grabbed all of those for their $150,000 that they put up front. But video sales can be considerable, and if they're handled correctly, we can actually make some money out of this labor of love. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a labor of love that produces some money. So anyway, this will come from home video sales. Now, the situation is that we had an ad, our own ad, $60,000 worth of ad, should have been $120,000, but because it was our own show, we got it for $60,000, on NBC when the show went out, November 10th. Boris was in charge of the ad, and he had managed to goof this up something terrible. He had managed to have the 800 number, which any advertising person will tell you, should have been on the 22nd or 32nd ad. I think it was 32nd, maybe 62nd. The entire time the ad is up there and repeated several times, it was up there for only about 10 seconds. Even so, people in the business reckoned that had the ad been properly constructed, we would have had three or four times the amount of sales. As it was, we had about somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 sales, $25 a crack. We had $250,000 sitting there in the bank waiting to be collected. First, we had to produce the home video version of the show, which was going to be substantially different from the original NBC show. One, because the home version had to be longer in order to make it attractive so that we'd have something different to sell. And two, because foreign markets wanted a two-hour show and not a one-hour show. So we had a month to do a show double the length, and we didn't have the footage because we had been counting, this is not Boris's fault this time, on being able to get back into Egypt to carry on with our work with seismographs and ground-penetrating radar and so on. So we would, in fact, have a lot more to show that wasn't in the NBC version. Since we couldn't get permission, and Wood said it's a bad relationship with the authorities in Egypt, it was a total non-relationship with the authorities in Egypt, so we couldn't get permission to go in there and do more work. So we had to cobble together a show with other footage that we had. Fortunately, we had plenty of material, so it wasn't the biggest disaster in the world. We put more of our own science on there, more of Robert Schock, more of the hardcore stuff, and also we put more of the kind of sensational stuff, the Edgar Cayce things, the things that NBC normally would not have wanted to touch, but we had absolutely no qualms about it, because in fact some of this material was, I felt, plausible enough to put on there without actually jeopardizing our own position. And in fact, truth of the matter is, I didn't even care about jeopardizing our own position, because I know when dealing with the forces of the establishment that it doesn't matter what you do, no matter how well you obey the rules that they have formulated and they themselves do not obey, they're going to find a way somehow or another to attack anything that they don't like. So I really don't give a if they accept or don't accept. And so I actually had no qualms about, for example, including in the expanded version a fairly extensive section on the Face on Mars, Richard Hoagland's work. A, because we really owed Hoagland a favor for introducing us to Robert Watts, who was responsible for getting us past the secretaries to make the NBC thing possible. And I like being able to return favors. And secondly, because we needed more footage anyway, we weren't able to have more original Egypt footage. And thirdly, because I thought that Hoagland's case was and is good enough, as long as it was handled with circumspection, to put up there as not necessarily a link to the Sphinx, which he firmly believes, and I'm very iffy about, but that the evidence for life on Mars, civilized life, you want to call what we're going through civilized, but that life on Mars is a possibility, and even the recent NASA stuff that supposedly discount and discredits it is not the case, I don't believe. In fact, there are not just Richard Hoagland, but there are a number of people who have taken up the cause of the Face on Mars who have highly credentialed and very careful people, and they are completely unconvinced that NASA is telling us the truth. And as a matter of fact, when it comes to government agencies telling you the truth, it's almost a rule of thumb, as far as I'm concerned. It's John's rules, political rules for his children. Rule number one, the government is your enemy. Rule number two, assume the government is lying until proved otherwise. Rule 2A, if the government is actually apprehended telling the truth, look for the ulterior motive, you will always find it. So whatever it is that NASA says, I take with many, many grains of salt until categorically and definitively proved to be the case. So in any event, I'm not making an apology for putting the Face on Mars onto our expanded home video version. In any event, we had to produce this, and it was a 30-day time limit where we had to service the orders, and by dint of an unbelievable amount of nonstop 24-hour-a-day work, we managed to get the product ready. And then all of a sudden, then we had a day or two left to ship them out. If we didn't ship, we've had it. Our company was going to close down our access to the credit cards, and effectively we'd be bankrupt. There would be no way of servicing, of getting out for the people who'd ordered them $250,000 worth of videos. Now, meanwhile, this all of the duplication of the videos and the orders are being serviced by a firm called DataPack that we brought on to do the fulfillment and send them out, a professional firm. And all of a sudden, we're now talking about late December. And now I get a call, desperate call from somebody at DataPack. And remember, Boris handles the business, I handle the scholarship and the writing, and everything is supposed to be, we're supposed to live happily ever after. As we now know, this is not happening. But in any event, I'm not involving myself in the business side of the enterprise. And I get a desperate call from DataPack that Boris will not pay them, DataPack, the $60,000. He will not release it to them because he is claiming that they are cheating us about something or another, to the extent of $1,000 or $2,000. So I call up Boris. No, these sons of bitches are ripping us off, blah, 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 blah. Boris has one of his instant tirades. We're talking about $1,000 here, or $2,000, even if they were ripping us off. There's $250,000 at stake. Oh, Boris says it's not the money, it's the principal. Well, that's not the principal, it's $250,000. And they're not ripping us off anyhow. Phone calls go back and forth, back and forth. Boris will not release the money. We're about to lose $250,000. Now I get a call from DataPack again. Isn't there anything you can do? You're a partner, aren't you? Yes, I say, I'm a partner. Boris handles the money. But this isn't there any other way that you can get a check cut for us? Because unless we've had, Boris has been abusive. He's been cursing us all out. He's been this, he's been that. He's lost his temper. And, you know, we're not going to send these videos out unless we get our money, our $60,000. The raw cost of the DVDs and sending them out and so on. And they say, isn't there anywhere, don't you have any rights to cash a check? And I think to myself, is John West the great businessman? Well, yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. I have as much right to cash a check as he has. That was the deal. We set it up in the beginning. It's just that he's been handling the business and he's been writing all the checks, and there's no reason for me to write any checks. And I said, yeah, I can cut you a check. And they say, well, it has to be out here by, when we're talking, it's Friday now, it's Saturday maybe, it's even. They need that money by Monday morning, or they don't have that money by Monday morning. They close the whole thing down and everything is scuttled. And it's now Friday night, I think it's Friday night, or maybe it's even Saturday. Saturday, the business is in Detroit. And they have to get me out. There's no way in which I can get a check there and free up this money for them without being there physically. And meanwhile, Boris has been threatening to close the whole account down and pull the money out of the account. He can do that somehow or another. Anyway, there's some way in which he can take the money out of the bank or freeze it there or some damn thing or another. Anyhow, they say, well, we'll get a driver. We'll send a courier to you, and we'll organize a ticket, and we'll have a driver meeting you at the airport, and we'll take you to the bank, you know, and you cut the check, and we'll service the orders, and everything will be okay. So I think to myself, gee, Boris always made threats. That was one of his stocks in trade, and none of these threats did he ever act upon. I mean, there's even threats of violence sometimes, but more often, I'm going to move out, I'm going to do this, I'm going to pull this, I'm going to call so-and. The point is that he could have been there on Monday morning as well as I could. He knew that it had to be out at that particular time, so I'm anticipating the possibility of even a physical confrontation with Boris on Monday morning, and I'm wondering, well, if it's going to come to that, it's going to be a showdown on the bank floor, and it's not going to be much fun. Boris is a very powerful guy, and not very fit. He's got a lot of extra weight on him, but he outweighs me by 60 or 70 pounds, and he's got a temper the like of which you haven't seen before. I've got martial arts training behind me, but I wouldn't relish a showdown with Boris. Anyway, it's a blizzard coming down now. It's late December. Somehow, a courier in a van that isn't even a four-wheel drive finds its way down an unbelievable driveway that, in fact, normally we're marooned up at the top of the hill for a couple of weeks of the year. Right now we are, as a matter of fact, with these terrible bad snows that we've had in the Northeast over the last couple of weeks. Just before it becomes impassable, a woman finds her way down to pick me up in a van. up we go, up the terrible drive, and we find our way to Albany. And I get the last flight, I guess it's Sunday now. We get the flight to Detroit, and I'm there in Detroit, 7 o'clock in the morning. A DataPack car is there to pick me up. We go to the bank. No Boris. No confrontation. This is good. Wasn't looking forward to that. And I sign the checks, and I give DataPack their $60,000. And so basically what I do is I pay off all of the debts, or all of the debts, nowhere near as many debts as we have, but I pay off all that I can. I allocate it, actually, in certain cases in terms of how much we owe, in certain cases in terms of how much people need it. Those who, even if they are owed more but are well fixed, get less. This is Solomonic banking, as it were, and I'm actually quite pleased about all of that. And so I cut all of the checks, I empty out the bank account, I go back to Socrates, to our home, and the company is saved. I mean, the orders are going to go out. The money will come back in. It has all been dispersed to the people who it's owed to, including Boris, as a matter of fact. He's got his bit for... and now I have the pleasure, after these 3 or 4 years of... more, 5 years, of riding in the back of the bobsled, taking care not to throw the thing off the track, which any wrong would have done, to now put on my parachute and throw the bobsled off the track. So that was a very interesting phone call, actually, where I called Boris up in the middle of the night, and I said, Boris, you know, this is John, and guess where I've just been? And where? The production fees, Detroit. And I said, yeah, what are we doing there? And I said, well, you know, DataPack, we owed $60,000 for them to service the orders. Those sons of bitches, they're ripping us off. I said, yeah, well, I paid them the $60,000. So, in fact, all the videos have been sent out. And then I went and I looked at all of the people we owe money to, Caroline and Bill Cody and everybody else. And I paid them, too. And I have a check for you, for your share of the production, and a check for myself. And that's it. There's no money in the bank, but we've fulfilled our obligations. You're no longer in charge of this company. And he hit the ceiling. Yeah, you take over the company, blah, 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 blah. I said, yes, that's exactly right, Boris. I will take over the company, which, in fact, is exactly what happened. I took over the company, so now it was my headache. And the headache was only just about to begin. Boris actually has the money to pay this back. I know that he has it because of one of the strangest accidents in the world. Boris fell off a toilet seat. The race driver and the bobsledder was in his apartment, standing on one of those old-fashioned toilets with a tank on the top. He was trying to fix the tank, and he was standing on the stool, and the tank came off the wall, carrying Boris, this 230 or so pounds, across the bathtub, fracturing a whole bunch of ribs. It turned out, as a matter of fact, that this fixture was an illegal fixture. So he sued the landlord of the little studio apartment and actually had a settlement of $300,000. $100,000 goes to the lawyer. He actually has the money to pay me back. It's there if I can only get to it. But still, it's a karmic debt that has to be paid, and we will follow this. I mean, the Boris saga goes on. Really, it goes on until Boris dies back in 2001. But meanwhile, it's the academic controversy that is fulminating along and boiling along at the same time, and we will conclude in our next episode, The Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, as we look into Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, Episode 4, where we go back into the evidence. We acquire much more evidence. We do another presentation at the Geological Society's annual meeting in 2000, and we set up, which we're still in the process of doing, the geology panel, a panel of geologists that we hope will get over there, some pro, some con, to our theory, and settle this matter of water weathering once and for all, allowing us all to get on with our rewrite of all of ancient history. Thank you.
Phoenix Fire would like to apologize for the quality of some of the audio on Show 5. We hope this did not deter your enjoyment. Thank you. Show notes available at www.jawphoenixfire.blogspot.com. Music and production by Geraint Hughes, www.thepodule.com. More information on John Anthony West is available at www.jawest.net.